So welcome. Welcome back to our City Matters series and tonight's conversation with three city shapers. And so we're going to have a great conversation tonight. A little bit about myself. I'm a postulant in the Anglican Diocese, so in the next 2 years, I'm hoping, God willing, and everyone else willing, to be ordained a deacon and eventually a priest in the Anglican Church. I've also recently completed my Master of Arts in Theology and Ethics, where my thesis topic has been a theology of the city. So I've been hosting these conversations as an extension of that thesis to ask the practical questions of what is it that we are experiencing in the city and where are we going? Where is the future going for us? And so just as a refresher, our very first evening, we started by asking the question, how is it that we experience the city? And we dwelt and dived into the question of built environment, the city as polis, or the political kind of the neighborly, the people functions of the city, and city as oikos, the city as household, that root word of economy and ecology, those kind of implications of how we structure the movement of goods and people and things throughout our city, and how we care for our well-being as a whole. And then in our second evening of lectures, we explored some of the ethics and some of the questions about where are we going, and where are we, and how do we engage with that? And I engaged us in three different Christian virtues that I think call us to three different sets of actions. So faith as a means of faithful engagement, of continued relationship, a staying with, and an engagement in trust with others. That's kind of faith that gives us flexibility to respond as we see things coming up, and a faith that gives us that chance to engage deeply. We also talked about how hope is our grounding for freedom, that our hope and our vision for where things are going is what enables us to get past the necessity of day-to-day life. And as Christians, that hope in the eschatological city, the new Jerusalem that's coming, that gives us that vision of something that's even better. And we talked a bit about love, love as agency, love as that capacity by which we're able to act and engage with others in our city to actually work out transformation. And last time that we were together, I had left us with a thought that I've been a bit theological in the last two lectures. I've been a bit heady, and so tonight my hope is that we're going to engage at a much more practical, pragmatic level. We're going to have conversations about what the city is looking like here on the ground and how we get there. And so to do that, I'd like to start by introducing our guests for this evening. So could I get Councillor Wong Tam to please stand up for us? This is Kristen Wong Tam. She is our city councillor for Ward 13. And she has been a city councillor in Toronto since 2010. Kristen sits on the Board of Health and the Planning and Housing Committee for the City of Toronto, as well as a variety of other community boards, such as 519 Church Street, the various BIAs in our area, as well as the local arena. Before politics, Kristen was involved in real estate and very active in the arts community in Toronto as well. So welcome, Kristen. Yeah, please do. We also have Stan. Stan, can you please stand up for us? Stan McCooch is a lawyer, and his focus of area is municipal and planning and environmental law. Stan sits on the Toronto Land, Local Appeal Body. There we go. And Stan's work there is involved in the kind of intersection of the appeals that go on with zoning variances and those kinds of bylaws. Stan also teaches occasionally at the University of Toronto in the Department of Geography and Planning. Thanks, Stan. And finally, we have Carmen. Carmen, can you stand up for us? For many of you, Carmen is a familiar face. And for those of you who don't know Carmen, Carmen is one of our cathedral sextons here. Carmen was here on our first night of our lecture series, and I'm glad that she is back with us this evening, but in a different role. So tonight she's here sitting with us as a member of our panel. Carmen is also a master's student at Emmanuel College, where she's studying spiritual care as well as psychotherapy. Carmen has experience in hospitals doing chaplaincy work and is hoping to take that chaplaincy work into her future, as well as looking at starting up some private psychotherapy practice as well. So thank you, Carmen, for being willing to sit with us on this panel. So what I'm hoping to do tonight is I'm hoping for us to be able to engage in conversations, So to start out with, I've got some personal questions that I'm going to ask each of our panelists. So I've got one question each for them, and then I've got three panel conversation questions that I'm hoping that I'll get a brief response from each of you so that you can respond from your own experience, your own workplace, your own practices of how you engage and shape the city. And then we'll also have a chance at the end for some conversations and questions from you, our audience tonight. So to start with, I'm going to pass you guys a microphone so that you guys are also mic'd. So that way we can share this microphone. So here, can you hang on to that for me? And I'd like to start with our city councilor, Kristen. So Kristen, my question for you is this. When you think about our neighborhood here on the east end of downtown, I want you to think and ask yourself and help us to see how it is our communities can show and develop practices of inclusion. How is it that your work as a city councilor helps us to facilitate that? And what are the ways that we in these kinds of faith-based communities or in our local communities can foster inclusion and diversity within our city as a whole?
Thank you very much for such a thoughtful question. And quite honestly, it's such a big question that you could answer it from a couple of different vantage points. One of the biggest challenges that I believe that we have, and I'm just going to call the downtown east. So Ward 13 Toronto Centre, after the gerrymandering of Premier Doug Ford in our last municipal election, we now have have the smallest geographical ward in the entire city. But we also have the most complicated social challenges of the city. And sometimes it feels like we're carrying the lion's share of responsibility. So we represent about 4% of the population. That's all we are, 4% of the population of the entire city. But yet we have about 32% of the opiate overdoses of the entire city right here in Toronto Centre. And Toronto Centre's geographical boundaries are actually from Bay Street over to the Don River, from Bloor and Charles Street on the north down to the Esplanade and Mill Street and Front Street to the south. So it's kind of got jagged edges everywhere. And what I'm seeing, and I think you can see it as well, some of it is very visible in plain sight, and some of it is not so much. But we see dire poverty. And I think this poverty is just getting further and further out of hand. For those who are already struggling to make ends meet, like it is now impossible in one of the wealthiest cities in Canada, but also one of the most expensive cities to live in. So we have people who are just stuck where they are with respect to housing. Young families cannot move up into larger accommodations, and those who are living with their parents can't move out because they're sort of stuck. We have people who are on the wait list for mental health supports, and the wait list is sometimes 9 months deep. If you need to have access to counseling or psychotherapy, it takes that long. We have people who are living on the streets and going into the ER, and we have about 100,000 ER visits a year. So all around us, what I see is just the safety net after decades of austerity just chipped away, and of course it's fraying. So the responsibility I believe that we have at the city is to, number one, work with our other partners, because we can't take care of it all, because mental health is not a service that the city provides. Neither is supportive housing or even deeply affordable housing, and neither is the availability of treatment beds for addictions. None of those are city-mandated services, but we're seeing it right across the downtown core. And the challenge that I think is probably the most, the one that speaks to me as someone who's a spiritual being, is that we are all feeling frayed, I think. So the edges of society is starting to feel like it's pulling away. And at the core of it is a sense of hopelessness. The problem's too large, too overwhelming, and people are feeling lonely and isolated. In order for us to tackle this, and this is the solution part, is that we have to begin these tough conversations and actually put down our phones. I'm carrying two of them with me tonight, but mm-hmm. really we have to put down those phones when we're speaking to each other and deeply hear and listen to each other when we're speaking, not just with our ears, but also with our hearts. So we break through the isolation, we break through the loneliness, and we know that when we are working together, this is a country and a city of big brains, big hearts. We can just about do anything, but we're not working together at three orders of government. We're not agencies on the ground are fractured and they're not necessarily coordinating or communicating well, but we have the resources and we have the people power. We just have to figure out how to work together once again.
Thank you so much, Kristen.
You're welcome.
Can you pass the mic to Stan, please? Stan, I am interested in the work that you do with the Toronto Local Appeal Board, the local appeal body. I'm going to mix it up because when I first read it, I was like board because it's a board of the city and it says body in the acronym. But we'll get there. We'll call it TLAB or something like that. Is that okay?
It's very commonly called that.
Sounds good. So my understanding is that TLAB is primarily a means by which the city is able to handle appeals in zoning bylaws. And I know that a large part of that work is to hold appeal meetings where various stakeholders come together to have their say and their input in some of those variances, those changes. And my question is this. How is it that you balance those various interested parties in those conversations and hear out the various voices? So how is it that you engage in those meetings, and what's your hope in the outcome of those meetings, those conversations and those consultations? And if you can share any examples, that'd be wonderful as well for us to get a sense.
Okay, well, how do we engage people? From my perspective, the people that come before us are in a situation where it's largely their first time dealing with the legal system. And most people don't know a lot about the legal system and how it works and obviously have a lot of prejudice and suspicion.
Stan, can I just ask you to speak into the microphone? Oh, sorry. Bring it a little closer.
Is that better?
So we've got the audibility.
All
thanks.
Right. That's better? Yeah, so people, it's their first experience with the legal system, and they come to the legal system for the first time before our board or our body, is whatever you want to call it. And I think it's very, very important for people to realize that they're being listened to, that they're being understood, that somebody cares about their concerns. So it's very important to have a hearing where rules are set so that people can be heard and listened to. They can have representation. There are very important values to be recognized that if they feel that way, they will feel that they've been dealt with fairly, no matter what the result. If they feel they've been dealt with fairly and they've been heard fully, so that it's very important to give them that opportunity. So part of what I do, and I enjoy doing it very much, is actually just listening to people, hearing what they have to say. And often I sort of bend the rules to make sure that everyone has the opportunity to be heard, and that in then giving a decision, that their concerns have been heard, in writing the decision to let them know that they were listened to. They may not win, they may lose, but at least they know that the person making the decision was listening to them and considering their concerns. I guess the second aspect of that is that it's not, with all due respect to the politician next door sitting beside me, that the decision is not political. The decision is not made because you know somebody, because of what your name is, because of where you're from, because of your wealth, any of those kinds of things. That the councillors don't influence us. We're not influenced by the number of people who turn up. We try to evaluate the decisions on the basis of good planning. What's good for the community? What's in the public interest? And so again, that the people understand who are before us and have to accept the decision, that that's the basis for the decision and not, you know, personal preference or who you know, as I say, any of those kinds of extraneous considerations. So, and since it's the very first time that people come before before the legal system, it is very important because I think it's crucial that people in society, that our society generally, holds the legal system in high regard. Because if we start thinking that it doesn't work properly, that it doesn't consider everything, the people feel they're not being heard, that there's favoritism, if any of that happens, then the whole system starts to break down and people will, look to other methods for their decision making. When I was teaching, and I'll just finish up with this, I remember I used to tell my students, and I used to represent both the developers and the city. I represented the city of Toronto many times, but as well as developers. I remember telling my students and one of my developer clients that law is a very noble profession. That it's because we have these methods of hearing people, listening to them, giving reasons for our decisions that are non-political, that are not based on favoritism, etc. For those reasons, we have civil order, and that's what's so important in our society, and it prevents and helps avoid corruption and violence and societies that do not function well at all. So those are my thoughts about that.
Mm, thanks so much, Stan. And can you pass the mic to Carmen? So Carmen, on our first night of the lectures, we had a disruption. We had a member of the community, for those of you who weren't here, who was probably at risk, homeless, maybe dealing with addictions and other struggles, who ripped open our door during a lecture, which is not to say to frighten you or to scare you. But you were the frontline person. As a member of our cathedral staff, that is part of your role and your responsibility, is that you are often the frontline person who engages with anybody who walks through the doors of our cathedral and of our community. And so my question for you is this: how is it that you handle those sorts of situations? How is it that you handle the realities and the difficulties of frontline work in a difficult and changing neighborhood? And where is that transferable to other parts of our life in the city? How does that transfer to your other roles in terms of the spiritual care you provide? Or how else does that play out in life in the city for you?
Thank you, Andrew. That evening, when the gentleman came into the building, it was one of those split-second decisions, I think. Working here and engaging with those who live in and around the cathedral, it's often a case-by-case basis. You have to learn to assess the person quite quickly when you're engaging with them. So I could tell that he was hungry, that he was very upset, and likely struggling with addictions, and he was also very angry. And so when I approached him, I tried to de-escalate, to calm him down. And he looked at me and he said, "I just want you to see me as real." And I said, "I see you. I know that you're real." And that's when he started crying. And I think a lot of the people, and Kristen, you referred to this, who live in this area, I think it's very easy for us to just not look at those who maybe make us uncomfortable, to not engage with them because we don't know what to do. We don't know what issues that they're facing, and we're scared, I think, to engage with them because what if we get hurt? For him as a human being, he just needed to know that he was seen. And so I think that's sometimes it's simply they come in and they're like, "I need a pair of shoes." I once had a gentleman show up, and I didn't even notice this. He wasn't wearing any pants. And he showed up, and I'm like, "Hi, how could I help you?" I didn't even notice. And he's like, "I need some pants." I'm like, "Yes, you do. We will get you some pants." And so it's one of those things where it's trying to ascertain. Simply, they might just want a conversation, or they were in need, like he was in need that night. So I think for me, number one is trying to assess the situation. I think number one would be recognizing the humanity of the person that you're engaging with. This is a human being, and as Christians, you know, this idea that each of us carries a divine spark. We're all made in the image of God, and acknowledging that in the other, I think it's very important. I think especially when we're engaging with people who are on the margins, they, and I've already said this, so I'm reiterating it, feel overlooked, unseen, that they don't matter. And it's very important that they recognize that they do matter. And I think that principle of acknowledging the humanity of another person is something you can take with you in life, whoever you engage with. I had it just this evening before the service. There was a woman looking at the dying seminar. There's a list there. And she was just standing there looking at it. And so it's like, hey, do you have a question about, you know, these lectures? And engaging with her as a human being, she has a friend who's considering MAID, you know? And so it's like how she feels about that. And, you know, so there are people in our neighborhood who are facing issues and problems and sometimes just need somebody else to hear. Just need somebody else to be present. And wherever you go, whether it's, you know, down to Metro to do some shopping or up to Yorkville to get your haircut, whatever it is, whoever you engage, you know, carries that divine spark, carries that humanity, and it's acknowledging them in your everyday life, I think. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you so much. That actually dovetails nicely to our first question, which is great. So these questions, I'm just going to open it up for you as a panel. If you have questions about each other's comments, if you want to jump in or ask those questions, you're sharing a mic, so please be polite. Be neighborly to each other. Treat each other with that spark of dignity that says that I see in you the thing that makes me human as well, the spark of the divine that says I actually see something beloved and cherished. And I hope that can be a spirit and an attitude for us as we start thinking about questions for ourselves as well. So my first question for our panel tonight is this. Who are the people that you keep in mind in your work that are your neighbors? How does this shape the work that you do? And what are the challenges or benefits of that vision of your neighbors? Whether it's an overly expansive vision of neighbors, whether it is an overly narrow vision, what are the benefits or challenges?
That is such a good question. My days are so long and my nights are even longer these days, largely because I have now a four-month-old baby at home. Thank you very much. His name is Keon, and he doesn't leave me with much sleep anymore. I never slept much to start off with, but now it's even worse. And I have to say, it sounds awful, but... the days and nights are blurred together these days. And I have to say, I really struggle to ground myself and to be mindful in the work that I do. And it's because there's just so much coming at us that is crisis and emergency. To be able to think proactively and plan ahead, which is what I really love to do, has been a struggle. I have to pull back and say that there's probably been two individuals that I've met that have been various levels of being street involved that probably their stories will stay with me for forever. One is before I became an elected official, this gentleman, let's call him George for the sake of things, he would always come into my cafe. I used to own a Timothy's World Coffee franchise at 500 Church Street in the heart of the village. And he would come in and in order for me to move him along, to be quite honest, like I kind of approached it this way, I'm going to give you a cup of coffee and please have a muffin, but I'm going to need you to keep going because he didn't bathe. And so there was a particular, you know, smell to this gentleman. So it became transactional. Hey, good morning, Kristen. I'm here for my coffee. I'm here for my muffin. And he would move along. And he always smiled after this relationship began. What was interesting is that he had almost no teeth. And so in order for him to even eat his muffin, he'd be like literally mashing it with his gums. And after a little while, I said, you know, do you want to get fitted for dentures? Is that something that you'd like? Because there's no way he would ever be able to afford it. And I didn't know about the city's programs and all that. This is me as a private citizen. And so it took a little bit of convincing, but eventually I convinced him that I should give him dentures. And so he finally took me up on this gift, and it actually made a world of difference. We had to go for several fittings, and it was very painful. But at the end of the day, he was able to smile and walk off with these dentures. And then I never saw him again. Mm. It was just this the almost like day after he got the dentures, he stopped coming in. I didn't know where he went. And I kind of look in the communities to see if I'll ever run into him again, and I haven't. Mm. But I'm always so curious to what happened to him. So there are these moments and times where there's these relationship experiences that one would have. I don't even know his last name, to be quite honest. And George is not his first name. But people come into your life and you're not even sure how and why, but they leave you with a lesson, and the lesson there is that, you know, I just needed to just ask, you know, what do you need? The second story is a little bit closer, and I'm just going to finish on this one. And this young woman is exceptional. She's street involved, but right now she's housed in a shelter in the west end of the city. And she travels all the way to our neighborhood at Yonge and Dundas. And there she hangs out in a parkette with about 30 other kids. So it's always very intimidating when residents walk by, because, boy, these 30 kids are hanging out. They're smoking marijuana. Sometimes they're engaged in fights because they get restless. But this young woman is exceptional. She's 22 years old. And we invite her into a conversation at Covenant House to say, what do you guys need? You know, because the neighbors were like, we want you off the lawn. And she was so articulate, but I found out later on she had a grade 8 education. She's 22 years old. And so she's been street involved for all this time. But she was, I actually thought I should give her a job at City Hall because she was such a good ambassador. She was able to work with young people until I realized that she couldn't read or write. And that would just, you know, how do I employ someone when we live in the digital economy where everything is by email and electronic communication? But all that being said was, here's a young woman who's 22 years old, living in a shelter, grade 8 education, smart as a whip, articulate, and she fell through the cracks. And I'm not sure when she's going to be able to get a job. I'm not sure when she's going to be able to pay her bills to get housing. But here is this human being with this lost human potential. Mm. So if there are two individuals that I can think of that I think about in this work, it would probably be George. And I'm going to call her Charity for now. It's just incredible. Like, these stories are there all over the city, all over this neighborhood. We just have to be able to, like, open up our hearts and actively listen.
Mm. Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, sure. I'm being neighborly.
Well, the question is, how do I treat the people who come before me or I interact with?
The question is about who is in your mind when you think about the neighbors that you're interacting with, and how does that shape your interactions? What are the benefits to the way that you approach that, and what are some of the challenges or difficulties you encounter in those things as well?
Well, the difficulties are the personalities of people that we deal with. But I guess the way I interact with most people, and again, to try to relate it back to the legal system, our legal system, I think, is founded on the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which sees every individual as important and to be respected and basically loved, the same as the Christian religion. Our legal system, to me, is very much founded on Christianity. And so whenever I'm dealing with matters involving law, and I've dealt with ones not only with TLAB, but I used to be a police commissioner and dealt with policing, and I was on police complaints and dealt with people who were abused by the police. So I've had a broader experience in terms of how individuals have been dealt with. And to me, the important thing is to treat them with respect, listen to them, hear their concerns. And recently I was in London and I went into the church in Covent Garden, and I read a welcome there And it really, to me, this welcome sign that was in the entryway to the church, I think it was St. Paul's Church, to me sort of sums up how I have to approach the people around me. And so I thought it would be useful to read it. And it's not too long, but so let me just do it. This is a welcome, but it also is, I think, very much guidance as to how I should deal with anyone who comes in. I'm coming in contact not only with in my legal profession and my work, but just as individuals wherever. And it starts, we extend a special welcome to those who are single, married, divorced, widowed, straight, gay, confused, well-heeled, or down on the heel. We especially welcome wailing babies and excited toddlers. We welcome you whether you can sing like Pavarotti or just growl quietly to yourself. You're welcome here if you're just browsing, just woken up, or just got out of prison. We don't care if you're more Christian than the Archbishop of Canterbury or haven't been to church since Christmas 10 years ago. We extend a special welcome to those who are over 60 but not grown up yet, and teenagers who are growing up too fast. We welcome keep fit moms, football dads, starving artists, tree huggers, latte sippers, vegetarians, and junk food eaters. We welcome those who are in recovery or still addicted. We welcome you if you are having problems, are down in the dumps, or don't like organized religion. We offer a welcome to those who think the earth is flat, work too hard, don't work. I just lost it. hang on. Don't work, can't spell, or are here because granny is visiting and wanted to come to church. We welcome those who are inked, pierced, both, or neither. We offer a special welcome to those who could use a prayer right now, had religion shoved down their throats as kids, or got lost in Covent Garden and wound up here by mistake. We welcome pilgrims, tourists, seekers, doubters, and you. And to me, that's sort of a modern way of really of dealing with anyone in any situation, whether I'm in a formal hearing, to really care about the person who's in front of me, what they think, how they feel, what their concerns are, no matter how obnoxious they may be, no matter how crazily dressed they may be, no matter what sex, what race, whatever, it doesn't matter because God's in all of us. And so I must treat that person with love and respect. And that's what I think about it all.
Thanks, Dan.
I need a copy of that.
Don't we all? We all do need a copy of that on our doors.
I can say that. I don't know if I should say this. But I sent it to the priest at the church I go to. I just sent it because I thought it was really great. I got back a note that said, thanks.
He's busy.
I think I touched on this in my first time at the mic. For me, again, it's acknowledging each person in their own uniqueness, their own humanity. And I want to do a disclaimer. I don't always do that. So just so you know, you don't always, it's okay if you don't always meet the mark. I know, Carol, I know. And, you know, I try. It's that awareness, and I think something even you mentioned, Kristen, is this idea of, like, mindfulness, or even being in touch with yourself, how it is you're feeling on that day. Some days are better than others. For me, my work in the hospital, it's often I was engaging with one patient who was 81, had fallen and shattered his pelvis, and this all happened in a shelter. So, and I remember being in rounds that morning, and they were talking about releasing him back to the shelter. And it's, and, you know, part of me thinks, like, this should not be how the system is. This should not be happening. So, you know, having a conversation with him, you know, trying to give him space to talk about what it is he's facing, what he's engaging with, how he's feeling about where he has found himself. I had it this week, there are a couple of ladies. We have the Adelaide Center over here, Fred Victor. And I think when they're doing cleaning at the center, the ladies will come over with all their belongings and just kind of hang out in the cathedral. And I was chatting with them one week. It was just before the midday Eucharist. And the lady was saying, you know, we lost our home of 30 years. And can you help us find a home? And I'm like, oh, my goodness. I don't even know where to start. And so, you know, I asked some questions and whatnot. And eventually, we do have a housing worker who comes to our drop-in. So if you ever encounter anybody in the neighborhood who's maybe looking for help with housing between 1:30 and 3:30 on a Tuesday, they can come in. I think her name's Megan. She's going to love this. She doesn't even know who I am, and I'm going to send people her way. You know, and this idea that, you know, their whole lives, like 30 years, like everything is gone, their furniture, everything. And so the reality of, you know, what some people face. And I think it's honoring that and listening to it. So wherever you are, like I don't know why, wherever I end up going, often people will just will tell me their life story. I think that's why I'm going into this field. I have a knack for, you know, just for creating safe space for people. And I think that's really important. And I think, was it you who mentioned isolation? This idea that, you know, as we're more connected technologically, we're more isolated. And, you know, when I had that encounter with that gentleman on the first night, he just wanted to be acknowledged. And, you know, we're disconnected from each other. And I think that's something, if you can, you know, make eye contact with the person who's, you know, putting your groceries through at the grocery store, have a little conversation. You have no idea what that person is going through. And, you know, they may live in Yorkville and have no debt, and yet having a bad day, you know? So it's whoever you encounter is, you know, it's your neighbor, you know, is the one that you can have relationship or some sort of connection with. So, yeah, that's how I try to live my life. I don't always do it well, but it's a work in progress.
Yeah. Thanks, Carmen. So if there's thoughts or things that you guys want to say to each other as well, feel free to like interject, borrow the mic from each other. I'm going to make a call for myself. I'm going to cut one of our questions so that I can get to community questions sooner. But if there's a comment, go for it.
I was only just, I used to represent the village of Yorkville all the way to Moore Park and Summerhill and Rosedale. And I was just whispering to Carmen that the people in Yorkville do have debt. That's how they got to Yorkville. Actually, maybe I can take an opportunity. Stan, you raised a very interesting point around the judicial system, that that's always fair, that it sort of sees the people. And that hasn't been necessarily my experience and the experience of people that I know who is trying to gain access to the legal system through fairness, or perhaps they're oftentimes incarcerated for the wrong reasons, or, you know, so forth. And the same thing with the political system. Like, we have designed systems and structures and institutions that just keep people out. There are certain people that get to the door much quicker, and there are some people where the door just automatically opens for them based on who they are. But we are all living in these structures now, all politically driven, that are government-sponsored, that are corporately driven, and there is less and less access despite the fact that we are living in this digital age of massive information. You have more information coming to you than ever before, and yet you have actually less access to justice, less access to political power, less access even to community power these days. And I just want to put something out because I know that this evening is a little bit heavy. And because these are some of the dark times, right? I am incredibly encouraged. I'm just going to talk about the things that I like to see. I'm incredibly encouraged by what I'm seeing from young people when it comes to fighting the climate emergency. They're telling us off, you know, and they're saying we haven't done a great job and that we've extracted every single natural resource that we possibly can, and we're not putting it back into the ground and we're not doing it in a very meaningful way. Every single tower that you see in this neighborhood and right across the world, everything that is man-made, human-made, it is extracted from the ground in the most violent ways. Minerals, resources, trees fallen in forests, and water that's pulled up to actually lubricate and make and form. Everything that is man-made comes from nature. And I think that what I hope will happen is that if some of us who, and sometimes I feel like I get in the way, I'm not sure if you do in the judicial system, but if some of us can sort of get in the way and co-create with young people the solutions of tomorrow, for them, it's so urgent. Like I'm hearing on the doorsteps that for young individuals, climate change and climate resiliency and climate positivity is the biggest issue and the thing that keeps them worried. I met 12-year-olds who are worried about their future, and I thought, oh my goodness, what have we done to you? You know, how do we give you some assurances that we're going to work with you to make things okay? But it's actually young folks who are just really amazing right now.
Yeah, love that. So the question that I'm hearing in that then is, what's hopeful? What's good? Which is a big question. And I'd love to hear, Stan, just your perspective from the legal side. How do we get to the good in the legal system? How do we get to what's hopeful? Is there hope in those places? And also, Carmen, as well, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that briefly.
Well, first of all, I guess I'd say as a Christian, I'm always hopeful. And not only a Christian, but I read in other religions, Buddhism, Hinduism, there is hope. God is in everything. And so, in my view, so there's always hope. But that does not, and what that means is, I guess, is that there's always a need for reform and change and making things better. There's no doubt that when I have these noble thoughts about the legal system, it's not to suggest that it's perfect by any means. There's so much more that needs to be done. It needs to be improved. There's no doubt about that, but it is much better if we look through history than it has been in the past. And while, you know, our current situation with respect to poverty, et cetera, is not ideal by any means. We have so much more to do. We're cognizant of it. We're working on it. We are doing things, and the legal system provides the structure and the organization and the wherewithal to make those changes. So if we don't have order in society and a system that enables change to occur in an orderly fashion, to me, we're going to have chaos, and that's not going to be very good. And the breakdown of a legal system leads to adverse results such as corruption or whatever, and you can sort of see that in the United States, I think, these days. But I don't want to get off into that. Mm-hmm. Basically, I am optimistic to think that there is a system. It's in place. We have to work at changing it, and it can be done. It is an immense system. I also believe that every little act that we perform, every little act of reform, every little act of kindness counts, that we're making our own little contribution to change. I know on TLAB, for example, to give you an example, we have a provision in our official plan, which is a document that governs the directions and goals of the city. We have provisions for protecting the urban forest and the urban canopy, the trees in the city. Until recently, nobody has really been bothering much with those sections of the plan that protect the forest. I, as an individual, think it's very important because of the concern about global warming, et cetera. And I'm now in my decision making forcing people to take that into account and to consider the policies about protecting the urban forest more rigorously than they have in the past. Am I making a huge change in the world? Am I stopping global warming? No way. I mean, that's a very tiny little, I write a decision, maybe nobody will ever even read it, I don't know. But I feel I'm doing my little bit. I'm trying to do good by doing the next right thing. And if we all try that, we all just, you know, work in that way, there is hope. There's immense hope, and society will continue to improve.
Thanks, Dan. I think for me, I appreciated what you said, Stan. The issue I take sometimes with the law system, it's very slow moving, I think. And I think there are some systemic issues with the system that we have in place right now. Specifically, my concern is when I think about these things, when I look at, you know, the precariously housed in this city. I was chatting with some people at my table earlier this evening. In my studies, we looked at the ACE scale, which is the Adverse Childhood Experience Scale. It asks 10 questions, and they all pertain to the home life within which you were raised. And if you answer yes to 4 or more of these questions, the likelihood of you being precariously housed, obese, having cancer, diabetes, addiction issues, and or in bad relationships is exponentially increased. So when I think about that, like, and I think about the people in our neighborhoods who are precariously housed, those who have addiction issues, you know, for me, you know, training as a psychotherapist, I think that this is such a grave need. And part of it is my frustration is money, just throwing money at a problem is not going to solve it. I think it's going to take more than that. It's actually going to take a concerted effort from those of us in society who answer yes to 4 or less questions on that scale. You know, it's this idea of, you know, polarization, it's us and them. I think information and understanding why it is people are precariously housed needs to be looked at. Often judgments are made, and that's what we do. We judge people based on what they look like or, you know, what cars they drive or whatever it is. And I think when it comes to understanding another's humanity, we need to be able to sit down and have a conversation to hear what it is that happened. I've thought about these things and I don't know what the answers are, but in regards to how is it as a community, as a church community, as a city, as a province, as a nation, how is it we engage in these issues that can help people on their way to wholeness again? Mm-hmm. You know, to look at the underlying issues that, like, homeless people aren't the problem, they're a symptom of the problem. and so where do I find hope? That's a really good question, because sometimes I'm really discouraged, I think. Yeah. And so it's, I think, in having conversations like this and having people ask honest questions. And the whole thing is, like, even for myself, you know, as a white, cisgendered, Christian female in our society, I have levels of privilege that other people in our society don't have. And sometimes it's difficult and it's awkward to have those conversations. I think when it comes to those who are precariously housed, it's the same type of thing. We feel awkward. Are we going to say something wrong? Are we going to make a mistake? You know what I say? Forget it. Who cares? Ask the questions, have the conversation. This is how we learn from each other. And I think this is something we need to come together and recognize. And I keep talking about, you know, our common humanity, but I'm going to keep harping on that. This idea that together we're better. And, you know, as a Christian, you know, Jesus talks about loving God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. We had that passage read in the service tonight. And loving your neighbor as yourself. This idea, what does it mean? Like, what does loving myself mean? You know, it's like, I brush my teeth, I wash my hair, I shower, I buy food, I ensure that I have a place to sleep, I ensure that I'm connected with friends and family who love me and affirm me and accept me. And you know, I think about that. I was part of a program called A Street to Home, run out of the Salvation Army up here, Jarvis and Shooter. Dion Oxford is his name. And it was looking at housing, like housing street, those who are on the street. And it's a great idea, and it's wonderful. But the problem was that a lot of people who were housed ended up going back to the street. And do you know what the number one reason why they went back to the street? Community. They had connection on the street. Whereas when they're in their house, in that apartment, there was no relationship there. There's actually a TED Talk, and I would challenge you to watch it on YouTube. Johan Hari, I think his name is, and they did a study on rats, and they had rats, and they had two types of water. Water, just plain water, and water with cocaine in it. And so the rats who lived isolated would drink the cocaine water. But once they put them in a community, they never touched the cocaine water. They drank the regular water. So it's this idea that connection is the key. So what is it we can do as a church community and as a subset of the community, of the greater community of Toronto, what is it we can do to foster connection with those outside of our walls? Like the gentleman on that night, I just want you to see me as real. How do we go about doing that? And I think that's where I find hope, is if we have discussions about, and not just discussions, let's do it. Let's get out there and let's see people. Let's listen to them. Let's hear their stories.
Yeah. What's fascinating, and I'm just like, I'm so thrilled by this conversation. It's just like, it's recognizing the immensity of the problems, recognizing that part of the issue is that we silo into the various areas or fields that we do. Recognizing as well, though, that there's this positive ripple effect that can happen when we engage faithfully, when we engage well, when we engage lovingly, and trying to piece all of that together against insurmountable problems, and trying to say, is there hope in that? And when we're facing crisis after crisis, and it's just this kind of conversation is starting that doing something. But let's turn to that doing something. I want to make this question short and practical and tangible. And so here's the question that I have. That's my third panel question for us. Is what is it that we as citizens can do to help influence your work in a positive way?
Sure. Thanks for the question. I love the term active citizenship. We use citizen as in sort of a global sense. So it doesn't matter if you have residency or citizenship, but just being an active, engaged member of society. Active citizenship to me means that we all take responsibility for each other. So I've actually said this really clearly in the meetings I've had with the mayor, in the meetings I've had with city staff, and it doesn't matter to me if you happen to be our member of parliament, who is Bill Morneau, Minister of Finance, or perhaps our MPP. I've said to all of them, and I've said to the community members, and I've said to corporate partners, we own the problem together. I am not interested at all in pushing it around. It's not going to work. But if we all stand up and say, you know what, we've got a problem, whatever the problem is, whether it's the opiate crisis or the affordable housing crisis or the fact that we have so many people living in poverty, we're the child poverty capital of Canada, we have the most expensive childcare rates across the country, like, you know, you're never going to find that on a city billboard or any Tourism Toronto materials, but yet we own those titles. I really think that we need to own the problems together. And by admitting that these are our problems, because of the social determinants of health, because there's people living amongst us, our neighbors and family members, brothers and sisters, who have answered four questions and more. We need to be able to own it together, which means that once we're able to do that and stop laying blame and pushing it around, we now need to say, how do we co-create the solutions together? And I do love the individual, because it talks about the, you know, what can you do as a person, what can you do as an individual, but I also love the collective we. And these are structural problems. They need structural solutions, which is where government needs to come in to actually lead. But I can tell you right now, in this neoliberal environment, in this free capitalist society where winner takes all, we're not going to get to the solutions, because we're chasing this world of plastic. And you can only be in the rat race if you're a rat. And I didn't say that. I think Bob Marley said it. But really, if we're going to change the system and the world and the structures, then we need to have an awakening. And if that's through the voices of Christians, progressive and fair-minded and forward-thinking, or if it's through my own faith, I'm a Buddhist, you know, we have to figure out how that comes together. And to cut through the clutter right now, and there's a lot of clutter. You open your social media channels, everything is algorithm and programmed specifically to target you. You have the messaging of what you sell and what you buy, and we need to dial that down, way, way down, and to have conversations like just like this. What gives me hope? Tonight, actually stepping into this room and having and seeing all of you so keenly interested in trying to figure out how do we do this together, is giving me hope. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Is it going this way?
What can you do to improve our situation, I guess, is the question. And I guess
also within your work environment. So how do my work environment engage in your work as citizens?
My work environment's pretty narrow, and I guess that makes the point that no matter, it doesn't have to be my work environment, but to choose a particular issue or problem or change that you'd like to see, get a purpose. It doesn't matter how small it is. As I say, I'm in a pretty narrow field right now in terms of what I can do, but I think I can do little things. And I think my view is that all of us need to find the joy in life is having a purpose that we're trying to attain, we're working towards. So if we find that purpose, whether it's eliminating poverty, changing the legal system to make it better, electing a great counselor, as we have here, working for her, whatever it might be, get involved in doing it. And that you may not be changing society as a whole. You may not be, you're not going to result in a new economic system for Canada or something like that. And poverty will continue if you're working on the poverty issue, but you will make little changes. You can make little changes. I think that I have to have faith. I have faith that, as I said earlier, every little good thing that I do, every little attempt I make at doing something good in and of itself is good. Every act of kindness is important. And in part of that, and it's, I think it relates to everything we've heard this evening, is dealing with other people, and doing that, dealing with other people with love and respect, even those people who don't agree with us. Because I think it's so easy to look down on others and say, oh, gee, they have the wrong ideas. They're no good. What, we should, sort of shun them or cast them aside. That reading that I gave, I think that I read, clearly indicates to me that no matter what, no matter who, no matter their point of view, no matter what they think, we still have to love them. And so in working towards our goal and working towards the purpose that we have, to always maintain that love for our fellow human beings.
Thanks, Dan. No, that's great.
So we're answering the question, where is it we find hope, or in like our work?
I mean, where is it that we as citizens, as neighbors, as people of faith, communities of faith, can engage this? How do we help and support the work that you're doing, whether it's frontline or in the spiritual care environment? What does it look like for us as citizens to be involved in that?
Well, I'm thinking when it comes to specifically my work in the hospital, where I find hope is in journeying with people, and also because I think a lot of people, specifically, you know, the population we're engaging on tonight, those who are precariously housed or addicted, a lot of them have had their agency taken away from them, and I think it's a matter of helping them reclaim their agency, affirming them in their personhood. So as I'm doing that, or attempting to do that in the work that I do, you know, it's where we as citizens, active citizens, we can journey with people. Again, I think it's listening. I think it's being open-minded to hearing another story. I think a lot of it, especially, I mean, this is why I love Emmanuel College. I've learned a lot about diversity and, you know, learning to keep your mouth shut when somebody else is talking, to hear what it is they have to say. Mm-hmm. Because often we rush in there with answers or rebuttals or whatever it is. And I think as active citizens, I think we need to start listening to what people have to say. And maybe in as we engage in events like tonight, or if like committees are formed, or you know boards are formed, that we then invite those who we're engaging with onto those boards or into those committees to make decisions for themselves. Like how is it would work, you know, in Moss Park if we were to, you know, have a group home or something like that. You know, like, what is it, because you have that lived experience, what do you have to say to that? Because I know nothing about living in a group home. What do I know? I can come up with all these plans, but again, agency, right? And so I think even as ordinary citizens, I think just learning to listen and to hear other stories can help in the journeying towards becoming a cohesive community.
Thanks so much, Carmen. I'm going to get, if I could just get someone from the DFL committee to come up, grab a microphone. We're going to take some community questions. I'm just going to muse a little bit with some of what you said while we get the microphone out. Thanks, Peter. It looks like you're coming.
What does that mean?
Yeah. Oh, the Dialogues for Living Committee. Sorry. I was using short forms, and I should be using full things rather than that. So we're going to have some space for community questions. We'll probably have time for three. If we can keep them fairly short and concise questions that we can keep it tight, that would be great. And we can ask questions directly or to the whole panel as a group to kind of explore what's on your hearts and minds this evening after this lecture and this conversation.
So Stan, this is probably mostly for you, but anybody who wants to answer it. So, you know, Toronto is just packed with condo development right now. I mean, you can't go down you can't go anywhere without seeing a crane or whatever. The streets are completely torn up from the big trucks traveling along them and all that sort of thing. And I find myself saying, who is going to live in these condos? Is it going to be the people who need housing? And what's happening in our own neighborhood when I see blocks of apartment buildings that are being replaced with expensive. So I guess my question, Stan, is I don't even know if this is the kind of thing that you have to make decisions on, but when somebody comes to say, oh, well, you know, we're going to build this great big condo building and charge hundreds of thousands of dollars for a measly few square feet of glass walls, is there any provision that says for every 100 units that cost more than $500,000, $750,000, that there are X number of places for people who are precariously housed. Is there any legislation, is there any structure in that regard that helps us build a city where we're not just housing people? You know, I don't know who's living in these buildings. I really don't. I know we're expanding rapidly, but that's a great question.
Carol. Thanks.
I guess there are a couple of things. One is that our counselor might be best able to answer there's what's called a Section 35 agreement, where when a developer gets increases in height or density, the city can require that they 37? Sorry, they've changed. They change the numbers of sections all the time. I never keep up with it. Anyway, Section 37 agreement the city can get something in return, and it can be money for affordable housing or affordable housing. There can be agreements for that. So that can happen. You have to remember that we live in a market society. Or a market economy. So there's bargaining over that. It's give and take. The developer can always choose not to go ahead and do it if the cost is too high, right? So we can't force them to build the housing. Now, the city or the province or the federal government can get into housing programs. There are times when they did, much less so now. So I'm not up to date on current federal policy on what's been announced in the election or hasn't been. But who's living in those places? Well, we have, I think, and again, the councillor should correct me if I'm wrong, about 100,000 people a year moving to Toronto just because of immigration, right? And it's what keeps our economy, to a large extent, as vibrant and as active and as good quotes as you want. It's the reason why we build these things and take the material out of the ground and everything. So it's a pretty, it's a difficult kind of thing to deal with. Oh, we don't want the people to come? Well, no, most people would say we want those immigrants and refugees. In fact, we have an immigration system which was much more points-based, and therefore wealthier and better educated people come rather than the refugees, although we have some of those as well. So we build, and again, don't forget it is market-based. The reason those buildings are getting built, there's a demand for them. People want to move into them. People don't want to live in the suburbs anymore. They can have a lovely house in the suburbs, with their backyard and their garage and all that stuff. They prefer to live downtown, where the action is, and where things are going on, and they're close to theater and museums and art galleries and everything that makes the city so great. Am I perhaps not using this? So the developers, to some extent, are responding to what people want. Mm-hmm. I mean, I worked for developers in the past. It used to be that they were building very, very small apartments, and they're getting down to 450 square feet, most of us would say ridiculously small. Then the market was changing, they'd start building bigger apartments. But, that's the market, and it's very difficult for governments to say, no, don't build what people want, right? So it's not an easy problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
This Section 37.
Yeah.
Only just to, I think, to add to what was just said. So who's living in these towers was your question.
My first question is, is there a mechanism whereby, in addition to building housing for people who can easily afford housing, that some housing, and that housing is replacing some housing that has been lived in by people who can't afford housing very much.
So,
like Regent Park, for example,
right,
and places like that.
So there's a rental replacement program at the City of Toronto. It builds above what the province has stipulated, and therefore, if there are six units and more, and this is getting technical, stop me if you don't want to hear it. If there's six units and more that are coming down, so they're being demolished, they have to be replaced like for like. And the tenant will have the right to return, and they'll have the right to return at the existing rent that they are being displaced at. Now, it's also important to note that displacement is expensive, right? So, and what we're seeing is not just six unit little storefront plus apartments that are being torn down. We're seeing apartment buildings with 120 residents in these buildings that might be 60 or 70 years old that are being torn down. So to answer your question, yes, there is a replacement program like for like. It's called the tenant replacement program at the city, building on top of what the province has stipulated. So the city goes above and beyond what the minimum stipulations are. However, there are lots of projects that are being built on parking lots that have no rental apartment buildings, that have no affordable units. So is there a mechanism, your question is, that allows the city to trigger the introduction of affordable homes into these new projects? The answer, short, is no. But the city has been asking for this there's been about eight different times at the provincial level for inclusionary zoning. And inclusionary zoning is probably the right legal mechanism to therefore legally compel a developer to introduce affordable housing or mid-range housing into any new development. So therefore, if we're going to give you X number of floors in GFA, so gross floor area, you have to then introduce some form of housing. But the Section 37 stipulation, and this is why it stopped me if it gets a little too technical, you will never be able to build enough affordable housing in this entire city on the back of Section 37. It is a garbage statement to even suggest that we can solve our housing crisis on the back of Section 37. Section 37 is some modest community exchange of dollars. If you can build long-term care facilities, you can build daycare, you can do park improvements, street improvements, you can build soft people infrastructure, or you can build housing. I cannot go to a community and say, what should, on this list of things that you need, and there are 10 different things that you might need, if we always say we need to build affordable housing. It's never going to be done in an adequate way. But I can throw in one more statement. We have seen this incredible global flight of capital and the financialization of real estate across every urban center around the world has now taken hold. This is one of the biggest challenges that we have, not just in Toronto, but it's happening in Vancouver, it's happening right across this country, it's happening right across America, Europe, Asia, is that we're seeing global capital that is nameless and faceless, all deposited into companies and into REITs that go off and buy underperforming assets that are oftentimes aged buildings, and they're evicting tenants, and they're putting in modest renovations, and the rents are going up substantially. This is what's happened to Toronto over the last 7 years that we have not been able to get in front of. And this is really a big problem. So the middle class are feeling the squeeze. People who are living in their homes with their parents, who are making decent income, like, you know, $60,000 is not necessarily undecent, but there's no way you can afford an apartment in the city when the average rent for one bedroom is $2,200. So we're stuck. And unless we actually change the structure of how money is moved around and how we evaluate real estate, and the fact that we have to, I would say, not let the free market forces rule the real estate market or any other economy, because it's all commodified, and a home should never be commodified to the point that it could be traded on a stock exchange and right underneath you, like your bed is pulled underneath because some capital was traded, some securities was traded. This is a major problem, and it requires structural change. Sorry for the long, technical, winded answer.
And, like, it's a hugely complex question, and it involves both, right? It involves questions of structural justice as well as questions of right law, questions of how much freedom do we need to give our corporations to be able to develop? And but yeah. also, how do we get control of those things? And there's no easy solution in a lot
Most
of ways.
Recently, I would say one additional thing is that our premier has, I would say, the 25-year new secondary plan for the City of Toronto, some of you may know it as Teal Core, it's just been gutted. 122 changes came down from the province, unilaterally done, and oftentimes these amendments that get ministerial approvals, there's modest changes, maybe 6 or 7, but 122 changes unilaterally gutting the city's new downtown secondary plan. That's the first thing that's just happened recently. The second thing is that I sit on the Planning and Housing Committee, is that there's a brand new report from our chief planner that stipulates that the City of Toronto requests the province of Ontario to reconsider its approach to housing and planning and to walk away from what the province is now embracing, which is the market forces. So it's a market-based economy that they're enshrining into the Planning Act. And so these neoliberal policies have failed and now it's failed with the fact that, the capital is coming into the city, the development lobby is very powerful, and now you have a premier and a government that's actually enshrining it into law.
Thanks. We have time for maybe one quick question. We are at 8:23 and I want to be mindful of time. So one quick question, if possible, to kind of keep it concise and to the point, that'd be great.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Abby. There is a lot in those two different comments and questions, and thank you so much for bearing witness to naming your story and your experience, the pain and the sorrow within it. So thank you for sharing that with us tonight. I think that I'm hearing two questions within it, and so I want to kind of distill those questions for us just a little bit. And I want to recognize that the second question about police and the legal system and that, I think it might extend beyond Stan's capacities to speak to that tonight. But there is that question about kind of the shelter system within the City of Toronto, the difficulties that are experienced there, and recognizing that there's a very complex system that is integrated from the city to shelter workers who work on the front line, hearing from both people within city management side of things from housing and the work that they're doing to pull together new plans and new ways of approaching intake and outtake, as well as the kind of issues of frontline workers and also the concerns of people who experience it as clients and people who use those services. So I'm just wondering, like, perhaps briefly, can you speak to what's going on within our shelter system and how we can either, A, which levels of government to start working on lobbying and how that works?
Yeah, no, thank you very much for the for summarizing that question, and thank you, sister, for speaking with such openness and sincerity and honoring us with what you've said. And obviously I believe you feel safe enough to have said it here amongst brothers and sisters who are listening. So thank you for sharing that. I would say that, I just said I would own the problem. I never said that we should push it off to the side. And so with respect to shelters, the frontline emergency shelters, that's a city responsibility. Supportive housing usually falls under the purview of the provincial and federal government. We all have to build it, but somebody's got to fund the on-site supports. Cooperatives are oftentimes federally funded, provincially funded, co-funded, but then there's subsidies that are coming in to sort of keep the rents sort of affordable. So everything I describe is like we need to work on this together. 40% of the population that's actually residing in the shelters today, 40%, are largely asylum seekers and refugees who've come recently. And it's not because, if you read the Toronto Sun, they'll probably tell you it's because we declared ourselves a sanctuary city. That's garbage. I'm just going to say it's nonsensical. Because the problem is that we have a major crisis around the globe, and people are looking for safety. And rightfully so, people are like survival of human beings. And they are sometimes climate refugees, right? So no fault of their own. And oftentimes when refugees do make it to our shores, they're usually the best in class, if I would to describe it this in such a way. They're usually the most educated. They're usually the ones that are able to, who have enough resources to get out of the place where they're experiencing harm or persecution or imminent death and violence. So we're actually, in some ways, we're getting the top brains of the world. But when they come here, there's an opportunity where they have to re-educate based on the fact that their credentials are not recognized, and so forth and so forth. So to answer your question about who's responsible for the shelter system, it is the City of Toronto. That is our responsibility. The population, 40%, is refugees and asylum seekers. That is the responsibility of the federal government. And the challenge here right now, the shelter system over the past, ever since the Syrian crisis, really exploded, has everything to do with the fact that there's a federal responsibility, which is the settlement of refugees and asylum seekers, and making sure that the paperwork is processed quickly. And even the Prime Minister will admit that the paperwork and the process is taking too long, and they've acknowledged that. The relocation of people as they come through the doors, as they come through the country and the port of entry, is that should be a regional responsibility. So that means that we have to have the provincial government step in and sort of help steer where the population should go. But the provincial government in this case has totally thrown up their hands and said, we don't agree with the federal policy. It's not our problem. Justin, you let all these folks into the country, you deal with it. So there has been a total lack, and that's with the new government, and the previous government just wasn't very competent. The previous provincial government just wasn't very competent, unfortunately, with the regional relocations, right? And so now we have a government who's just hostile to any type of work around regional allocations. And so the Toronto shelter system is collapsing under the weight of the problem. So yes, the city owns the problem with respect to the emergency shelters, but as I've just described, which will not be able to come across in any short media soundbite, because the problem is so much more complex. So we're really struggling at the City of Toronto with what is happening there. And then on top of that, we just talked about the housing crisis. So you compound all of that, and the fact that people are living in poverty and that the cost of housing is just through the roof, there's fewer and fewer options. There's 8,000 people, I would say maybe 10,000 people, let's just say, every night in the City of Toronto who's homeless. Almost 9,000 people that we can account for through the street needs assessment. And let's say there's another 1,000 that are just floating in the ravines, under the Gardner, in the portlands where we cannot see, or perhaps encamped on any storefront on Yonge Street. You can see it right over there. That's 10,000 individuals. We have to build 1,000 more new shelters over the next 3 years, and it's very difficult to cite where those new shelters are going because we have communities that were saying no to them. Mm-hmm. Complicated in every sense of the word. Shelters are overcrowded. Shelter workers, frontline shelter workers, are very poorly paid. And they're being asked to do this yeoman's work of relocating people into housing, and housing that doesn't exist. It is some of the most heartbreaking work that we have in the office, where I've got people who are looking for housing, and I keep having to tell them I don't have any. So I'm sorry that I don't have a quick answer. But I can tell you that, the answer has got to be we don't give up and we don't walk away, even though it feels very large. But you ask the question of who's responsible. I'm responsible. We're responsible. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We are at 8:45. We are 15 minutes beyond our time tonight. So I want to call up our dean, our new dean, Stephen, to come on up and join us at the podium.
So, Stan, do you remember the junk food eater you mentioned? This is why I don't have my collar on. It just won't close anymore. So I promise to change that. Thank you all for coming tonight. It's been a very thought-provoking evening and series. And I'm thinking of the passage in the letter to the Romans that says, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. It's the changing of our minds around each other and the problems that we face together that will change the world. So thank you to our three panelists tonight, to dear old Carmen that I call Ms. Miranda, and to Kristen and to Stan. Thank you very much for your time with us, and we really appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you to the Education Committee, the DLT, DFL, sorry, DLT is Diocesan Learning Team, different group, for helping to put this event together. But the brains behind this operation, for this series at least, has been Andrew Kuhl here, who has been magnificent, I think, handled every night with grace and wisdom and intelligence, and we are so blessed to have you, Andrew. Thank you so much. Now, I wouldn't get a Christmas card from the vicar if I didn't push the Snell lectures before I leave. So our next set of lectures you'll see on, excuse me, on the table in front of you. And if you don't see one, grab one because there are bunches around. Theology, Liturgy, and Prayer in the Public Square with Canon Lizette Larson Miller. So you can see the details there about the next set of discussions and lectures around how we respond to a world that continues to grow in terms of the depth and layers and complexity of need. Thank you. And
I just wanted to say again, on behalf of Dialogues for Living, the Adult Education Committee of St. James, thank you all so much for coming out. If this is your first night, your third night, or your second, thank you just for being here and coming and supporting us, and we look forward to seeing you again at our next series. Thank you all, and have a very good evening. Go home safe. Thank you.